Great. Good afternoon and welcome to this session, Asset Liability Management in a Low Interest Rate Environment. My name's Tony Boffinger. I'm from Challenger and I'll be chairing the session. It's great to see such a good turnout here and also on the webinar. So I think we've got over 130 people on each. So I think that's a great turnout and really reflects very highly on the interest in the topic at hand. So I will introduce our two speakers. Our first speaker will be Chitwe Wong, who has recently accepted the role of Data Analytics Manager at AIA Australia, having previously been Capital Management Actuary for the previous 3 years. He's responsible for ICAP-related developments, capital management and asset liability management at AIA Australia. He's got over 10 years of experience in the Australian financial services industry and has held roles in capital management, project management and financial reporting. He'll be followed by Anthony Kerry, so I won't interrupt the flow. I'll just let him hop up. But he is currently head of investments at CommInsure and since 2011, and he's responsible for the end-to-end investment management of CommInsure's investment portfolios totaling around $12.5 billion. This includes responsibility for investment strategy, asset and liability management, and investment operations. He's got over 25 years' experience, having held senior roles across a range of functions, including actuarial and finance, product development and management, corporate and customer strategy, consulting, and investment management. Prior to working at CommInsure, he's worked at MLC, MBF, Clearview, Tower Life, Tillinghast, and Commonwealth Life and Prudential as well. A number of those companies, of course, having different names now, but which he did tell me, but I haven't bothered to say. Welcome, everybody. Please be ready for questions, which will be held at the end, but bear it in mind as you're going through. If there's anything that you would like to raise, there will be time, I hope, for that. I'd like to call on Chitwe to start. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Chitwe, and I've been working in the capital role for the last 3 years since Ledger came about. What I thought would be useful today was to share some of the thinking behind when we went through the process of setting up the ALM framework. As part of my previous role, I had the opportunity to set up the ALM framework. This is today's agenda. What I thought would be useful was to go through the likely stakeholders that you have to engage as part of setting up the framework. What are their roles and responsibilities, the motivations and concerns, how we address those. The ALM framework, how an effective ALM framework would look like, and the thinking behind the setup of the framework. I'll touch on some of the observations I have on the low interest rate environment as well, the implications and some of the actions that we can have there before I hand over to Anthony to talk about the second half of the presentation. So what is the key question we're trying to answer today? This statement summarizes it. It's to implement a framework that allows the investment function to take on appropriate investment risk. Note the keyword appropriate here. I'll go into this in a bit more detail in the later part of the presentation. Stakeholders. So this setting up an ALM framework can be quite challenging because it involves quite a number of different stakeholders. I found this to be the most interesting part of the exercise, where you work through what each stakeholder wants to get from the exercise, and you work through their motivations and their concerns and how you address them. And this was key in getting the required buy-in into the ALM program. So who are the likely stakeholders we need to engage? We'll start off with the obvious ones, the investment team. From my experience, they want to be able to carry on with their day-to-day investment operations without too many unnecessary constraints. So if you're setting out ALM framework and we are introducing new limits, we should review the existing limits, see if they can be effectively replaced or even better, removed. They want to understand how their investment decisions affect the various outcomes. So if they go a bit shorter or longer than the target duration, Are we still going to be able to hit our profit targets or our dividend targets? That link may not be as apparent. And thirdly, very, very importantly, they do not want their scorecards to be unfairly penalized by ALM-related decisions. So instead of benchmarks and scorecards need to be reviewed and replaced or changed accordingly. Next, we have the actuary and finance function here. We are interested in managing the financials, be it managing earnings volatility to make sure we can hit our profit targets or capital position or making sure that to safeguard our ability to remit planned dividends. We want to keep our risk exposures within our risk limits. And also, we want to look at how the investment decisions will affect our product development and pricing. What I want to mention on a previous slide as well was that actuarial and investments, those two teams form the first line of defense from ALM risk perspective, and it's usual to see tension, observe a healthy tension between the teams because they are working on the opposing, focusing on the two opposing ends of the risk and return spectrum. But what we don't want is to have the investment operations completely ignoring the actuarial function when it comes to investment decisions. Here we have the second line of defense when it comes to risk management, and we have the risk team. And their main role here is to challenge the effectiveness of the risk monitoring process. They want the risk to be well managed. So it means that we need clearly articulated risk appetite statements, appropriately granular risk limits, and also regular review of the ALM framework. We also have the shareholders here, which are represented by the board. They want to have the comfort that management are achieving the shareholder returns, required shareholder returns, and also the risk is effectively managed. The board also owns the ICAP, so they have an interest in the ALM management of the firm. I've listed other stakeholders here, but they may or may not need to be directly engaged when it comes to setting up an ALM framework. Move on to hedging objectives. So this is a good topic. Depends on what is more important to your company. If you want to manage earnings volatility to make sure to be able to hit your profit targets, you may want to rebalance your assets to match the profit emergence. If you wanted to safeguard your ability to remit planned dividends, you may want to match to a different target to minimize capital charges, for example. And you can have the combination of the above. So say this, depending on your financial year, if you're doing very, very well, you hit your profit targets, but you're not that close to your dividend targets, you may want to switch to protect capital. In the event where your dividend targets are safe, you may want to move to protect profits. And the key point to note here is that you can't hedge both at the same time. So the risk needs to be very clearly drawn out here. Your board needs to be aware that if you're matching to a profit target in an environment where interest rates are falling, you may not be able to achieve your dividend target. So is that an acceptable outcome? This sort of risk have to be drawn out very early on in the piece. And also this is not meant to be a complete list of all hedging objectives. You could have different objectives by fund. So products, say if you have a power fund, you may want to make sure that policyholders' reasonable expectations are being met, and that the fund can be self-sustained under a range of plausible stress scenarios without further injections from the shareholder fund, for example. On this slide, I'll just look at how it could work in practice. So the actual the department, or maybe the chief actuary, could set the target asset duration, say to 7 years here, if the objective was to pay dividends. The investment team has the choice to either move to the target or to deviate operationally or tactically as long as they're within the risk limits. So the risk limit here is a 0.3-year deviation from a target of 7 years. It can also be expressed in a different way, because if you deviate from the target, you incur more capital charges. And you could express the risk limit as additional capital you incur from moving away from the target. As part of ALM framework, you may want to introduce the concept of a total risk budget for capital as well, for asset risk as well. Say the main objective is to safeguard your ability to pay dividends. You may want to spend no more than 10% of your capital in asset risk. And the investment team has the ability to flex around. So if they took more interest rate risk, they have to take less of credit risk and so forth. There's quite a bit of thinking in coming up with this sort of risk appetite statements and limits. Probably should I put it on these slides as well. There are three criteria that they would think about. First is the capability. Can the team, where's the capability of the investment function? Is it to take credit risk or interest rate risk? Typically, you will find that that's not, that the strengths are in either equity research or fixed income research, not so much on taking bets on whether rates will go up or down. And that's probably no appetite from the board as well to take excessive interest rate bets. So as a result, you see that the credit risk limit is a bit higher than the interest rate limit here. Secondly, you look at whether the risk is well rewarded. So credit risk, if you took it, if you bought a corporate bond and it doesn't default, you get the credit spreads at the end of the day. Interest rate risk though, the expected returns depends on your view of interest rates. You have to have a strong conviction before you can take a bet, and usually there's no appetite for it. But you can have some model tactical deviation in your risk appetite if you wanted to. So that the third thing is stress scenarios, and using that to inform your target surplus and how you set your risk appetite. So you may want to be able to survive a target surplus event or some sort of severe but plausible event based on your risk exposure, and don't want to have risk exposure beyond that. And this is the actuary would set up the limits. The investment team or function would operate within the limits, and the risk team would challenge the appropriateness of these limits. Here's another example of how it could look like in practice. So just on a risk monitoring process point of view, at the most basic level, you could plot the risk exposures to the risk limit in a traffic light report, and this will be distributed weekly to the relevant risk committees or the board. The complication here is setting up the risk monitoring tool. There needs to be a lot of investment here, because assets can be revalued daily. You can just get it on Bloomberg and you can get the values then, and you can stress them however you want. But with liabilities, it's best on a best estimate view of what it is at every single point in time. And we don't revalue liabilities on a daily basis. So you have to make some assumptions between the reporting dates, and you have to have a framework to review your model to see whether you're capturing the right risk exposures and your assumptions are valid between valuation dates. Once the target is set, the investments we should have X number of days to implement, and then this should be fairly reasonable. A breach reporting. If there's a breach in any of these KRIs, for example, here the interest rate KRIs being breached, and this should be reported by the investment team to the appropriate risk committees, along with the reasons and restoration plans. So if your liability profile is fairly standard, and then it doesn't move a lot with claims experience or interest rate levels, the investment team could potentially build this tool, because it's more focused on asset side. But if it's your liability valuation is a bit more complicated and it has a lot of complex features, the job may sit within the actuarial team here. The daily monitoring would usually be done by investments, and risk would challenge the effectiveness of the monitoring program. This is one example I wanted to bring up to highlight a separate point. So you have very complex liability features that can't be fully hedged. Liability portfolio where you can't get assets to hedge them. Say the duration could change with claims experience or interest rate levels. You can't get assets to match that. So even if you hit the target, there's a minimum amount of capital you need to hold. When it comes to breach reporting, you want to make sure that the investments are not affected by this. So you may want to break down your interest rate limit into two separate components. The part that can be controlled by investments, so whether they deviate from the target, and the other bit, which is not within the control of the investment team, where changes in duration targets are affected by the changes in liability profile. Here's just a whole laundry list of other considerations. We touched on capability before, complexity or liability profile. There may be challenges in finding assets to match the liability profile. Depends on, you may have considerations on how precise your hedging program is. The more precise it is and the more volatile the target is, there could be more costs associated with rebalancing your portfolio, and you have to balance that against your risk exposures. Hedging instruments and collateral requirements. I'll expand more about this. So if you look at, just as an example, in interest rate swaps, counterparties are usually happy to accept high quality assets, or even sometimes the big four banks as collateral. And if liquidity is the concern for your firm, this may be the option to go for, but you will still be exposed to spread risk because it's not completely risk-free. Whereas for government futures, though, the collateral is typically settled in cash. So if you have the liquidity in place to deal with the collateral, you may want to go for government few futures. This is because you don't have spread risk. It's government, so it's risk-free. Swaptions, if you want to move between different objectives very quickly, you might consider those, but comes at a cost. Last point on group-wide ALM strategy. If you had a parent, you may want to consider the group-wide objectives, and you want to get alignment there, and you may want to manage your risk exposures across the group. You could trade between different entities in the group and keep the bid-ask spread within the group, and you could trade more without incurring the cost of rebalancing. I'll touch on some of the observations I have on a low interest rate and environment. I should preface by saying that this is just my view. It doesn't represent AIA's view on the topic. Usually you find discussions that are related to the low interest rate environment are typically related to product design and policyholder behaviors, whether it's annuities, variable and annuities, par products. There's probably not enough time to cover that in sufficient detail today. What I wanted to do, though, would be to look at this from a return on regulatory capital point of view. I've drawn out here the capital charges for credit risk and equity and property risk. You can see the stark differences here may limit the appetite for growth assets. In the low end interest rate environment, the industry may not be able to perform as well relative to other unregulated industries, and there may be a concentration in credit risk just because of the way how capital charges are being structured. So what can we do about this? There's limited options within the constraints of logic. You can have equity exposure, maybe with a put option overlay or some form of downside protection, but you need to get approval for capital relief. That's probably the one that's closest to getting equity exposure. You can look at highly subordinated debt or infrastructure debt where the returns are much more closer aligned to the equity components. Maybe hybrids where the conversion option is very far out of the money. Or an internal model if you can go for that to justify that you want to have a diversified portfolio, not just focus on credit risk, and you want to you want to have appropriate way weighting in a portfolio on growth assets. Otherwise, you just have a couple of capital charges. So it's quite limited options there. Had I thought about this, and maybe as an industry, we could potentially influence APRA to consider an alternative approach in setting the capital risk charges. So if you could fund some sort of research in the industry to find out what the ideal strategic asset allocation is for the industry with appropriate weighting on growth assets, we could have a tiered capital structure or capital charges. So if the ideal SAA is 20% in this example, we could have an appropriately lower capital charges up to 20%, and beyond that, just ramp it up. There was another point I wanted to raise here on reporting considerations as well, because there may be a lot of concentration on credit risk. This is something you can find in Solvency II, what they call the matching adjustments or the volatility adjustment. What it means that if you have liability that's predictable and you can effectively find assets to match it and hold it to maturity, you're actually not exposed to the spread risk or the liquidity component of the risk. You're exposed to default risk, but not liquidity risk. So in this case, under Solvency II, you are allowed to adjust your risk-free discount rates to include the spread adjustment, and that will get rid of the reporting noise, but also at the same time, you push down the capital requirements. But I'm sure APRA has another way to balance that. It's just a consideration to look at, because it's already in Solvency II, and I've included a reference there to the UK Health Insurance Standard that talks about this in a bit more detail. I think that was the last point I want to cover for my part of the presentation. I'll now hand over to Anthony.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for coming. My name is Anthony Carey. I'm the head of investments for CommInsure, and for my sins, part of my role is responsibility for asset and liability management. So I do hasten to point out that I'm here in a personal capacity, and my professional capacity is an actuary, not as a representative of CommInsure. But what I'm hoping to share with everybody today is some practical considerations for asset liability management within organisations. So what I want to start with is actually the liabilities, because in my view, I guess, liabilities are key to an effective asset liability management program. They're the essential foundation from which you build your program, in my view. In order to have an effective asset liability management program, you really need liabilities, goes without saying, that are accurate. They also need to be timely, and they need to be appropriately granular, so you can actually look through those liabilities and see what the impacts are of interest rates or inflation. Now, we don't live in a perfect world, so you never get everything that you want, but as far as you can get these things, it'll make your life a lot easier. But in particular, what is essential is being able to distinguish which parts of the liabilities are sensitive to inflation or to interest rates and which aren't, because you don't want to be hedging the wrong things. The other thing is that there's a very strong link, in my view, to the setting of the actual liability economic assumptions and effective outcomes for ALM strategies and how you actually go about then managing those ALM risks. So in order to be effective, your assumptions really need to be based on a market indice. So you need to be able to monitor and manage them on an ongoing basis, so your assumptions equally need to be able to be updated on an ongoing basis, and they need to relate back to something that you can see in the market. So if you have liabilities and assumptions where they're set on roughly between maybe this index and that index with an adjustment, and then I use my professional judgment to come up with that assumption, you have no hope. You cannot have an effective asset liability management program on that basis. Equally, if you change your assumptions once a year, you equally have no hope. The market moves on a daily basis. You certainly can't be waiting a year in order to update your liabilities. Now, this may sound obvious and simple, but it actually is far more complex than it sounds, and it actually raises a lot of questions in how assumptions are set, and driven from that, what is the most effective derivatives or assets in order to match or hedge those liabilities? So starting first, I guess, with interest rates, because it's far more common in the market, my personal view is you need to change those assumptions at least monthly. So you do need to have a monthly update of the assumptions and the cash flows, and they need to be based on a market rate. Now, just to make life interesting, there are two different market rates that you can use. There is a swap curve, and there is also a government bond curve, and they are different. So you really need to decide which is being used here. The other thing is, in order to be ideal, the perfect world, you really need to set your assumptions based on that full curve. So not just a single point on the curve representing the duration or a truncated curve. Assumptions really need to be set across the curve, because all of your cash flows don't just occur on that one average point. You really, as a result of that, your best estimate assumptions will then follow the market, in which case you can look at the asset side and make sure that that side is equally following the market based on the curve. Similarly, for inflation rates, again, monthly would be my recommendation, and again, based on a market index. And yes, once again, we have two different indices in the market that you can choose from. So there's break-even inflation or there's inflation-linked government bond indices. Again, they are different and they move in different ways. So you really need to make a decision of how that works. And similarly, you want to base it on the full curve. And again, that's not as easy as it sounds, but if you can actually set assumptions on a full curve and model that within the liability modelling, that makes life a lot easier. I guess the extra thing, in my view, with inflation is that while interest rates, in some ways, it's pretty obvious what's linked to interest rate movements and what's not, it's a little more vague when you think about the liability cash flows for inflation and which ones really are linked to market inflation and which ones aren't, because it's really those ones that are linked to market inflation that you can manage. And that is a matter of judgment. That is a matter of what your board is looking for and what management is looking for and how your appointed actuary is happy to set those assumptions. So if I look a bit more detail at what inflation or some cash flows there are, at a high level, I think of them in three different buckets. There's probably more, but at least at a high level. You've got the inflation that's related to disability income claims in course of payment. So that's where the customer has claimed, they're on claim, they'll be on claim for, you know, however knows how many months and years. And there's a direct link, generally, in that those payments do go up on an annual basis in relation to a CPI measure. So that's fairly clear that's linked to CPI, so it's not too bad, too hard to manage. On the other side of the scale, you've got renewal expenses, which in my view has a much more tenuous link to the CPI, because there's a large component of that is wages growth, which is not based on the CPI. You've also got project investment, and overall you actually have the ability of your organisation to manage its costs. So if you're sitting there and you're thinking, oh, over the past 5 years, I can see that my company has doubled the rate of inflation, the expenses are out of control, is that how you should be setting your assumptions? Or equally, if they've been really good with cost control over the past 5 years and it's half the rate of inflation, should that be how you're setting your assumptions, taking into account those things? So there's a lot more professional judgment in some ways if you think about the economic consequences and the economic meaning behind the cash flows for renewal expenses. And then what I'd look at as the last bucket is sum assured growth. And that's where the future cost of claims is being offset by the future premium growth as your sum assured increases. Now, often those sum assured increases are somehow linked to the CPI, but the complexity is in the product design. So there'll often be caps and floors in how much those will be allowed to inflate. You've got customer behaviour because people can opt out every year those increases. And then finally, you've got pricing. So it's the relationship between the claims and the premiums and how that's been priced. Actually, if inflation goes up, you could actually make a profit or you could make a loss. It really just depends on how the pricing bases are working for these things. So there's a lot more to think about in this bucket and whether or not it can be managed. So at the end of the day, all of these different cash flows could be treated differently. They can also be treated the same, but it really depends on risk appetite for the board and for management. And that will determine what sort of an effective strategy that you can put in place. So we've talked about the L in ALM, the A in ALM, which is kind of where I mostly come in. So what strategy to use? Should we be using a matching strategy or should we be using a hedging strategy? So the way I think about this, a matching strategy uses real assets as the, you know, the main part of its strategy, be they nominal or inflation-linked government bonds. Trying to put an asset program in place to largely match the duration of the cash flows in order to match the liabilities as a result of that. So it tends to be a more high-level strategy. Hedging, however, involves the use of derivatives, either largely or completely just the use of derivatives. And as Chidwe said, there's interest rate swaps, there's inflation swaps, and there's also bond futures. And you put those derivatives in place with counterparties in order to offset the movement in the liabilities. Which ones to use? That's a very interesting question. There's a number of different drivers to that decision. I'll start actually with the third bullet point because in many ways that's the most important one in my view. It really depends on what precision of outcomes of ALM is required. What is it that your board and management are looking for when you're managing this risk? Within that, though, you also need to look at how good are the liability cash flow data that you can get, how granular, stable, how frequently updated, because we don't live in a perfect world. We can't just press a button and have those things. So that also determines the more, I guess, high level or infrequent you're getting that data, the more it points you towards a more high-level strategy and a less imprecise kind of matching outcome. Similarly and interestingly, the size of the exposures to be managed is also something that needs to be thought of. I know in my professional life there's been at least one occasion where the amount of inflation-linked bonds that one would have to buy in order to effectively manage inflation risk was greater than the size of our assets. So that's a definite limiting factor. So you do need to look at those types of practical outcomes as well. As Chidwe also said, you need to think about costs. This isn't just a benefit equation, it's a cost-benefit equation. So what are the costs and how frequently should you be trading? And again, even though I've said personally, it would be great to have all of these assumptions set on a curve, in the real world, that doesn't always happen. So you really need to look at how those assumptions are being set in practice. So the last thing you want to do is do something that is inconsistent with the way those are set. And similarly, within that, whether or not those assumptions are being set on a swap curve or a bond curve. So you really need to understand which of those curves that you're looking to manage. And I'll go through that in a bit more detail in the next few slides. But first, I'd like to talk about what I will call the fallacy of the perfect hedge. So I don't know how many times I've been asked this question. I think most people that work in ALM have been asked this question at one point or another. Oh, I thought that we were hedged. Why is there not a zero outcome from your hedging this month? There will never be a zero outcome from your hedging in any month, unless you are extremely lucky, and then I would double check the numbers, because there are many different aspects driving those ALM outcomes, and you can't hedge everything. We don't live in a perfect theoretical world. You really can't get a zero outcome from your hedging. So going through a number of those, or the high-level ones, one is data timing risk. Liabilities get calculated at the end of the month. They affect the reporting for that month. You get the cash flows probably several days later, and then it will take you a day or two to actually do the trades to match. If suddenly those liabilities have moved quite dramatically because assumptions have changed, that kind of thing on decrements or... And at the same time, interest rates or inflation moves against you in a large way and the market can move quite rapidly, you will get a large impact as a result of that. So clearly, the faster those you can get those cash flows and you can do that hedging, you can reduce that risk, but it's never a zero risk. It's never a perfect world where you can instantly press that button. You've got what I would call liability estimation risk. We're talking about liabilities in many ways, they're not real cash flows. You can't really touch them and see them. They're based on models. They're best estimates. So changes occur to liabilities. There can be high-level adjustments. There's the periodic changes to the actual economic assumptions. So as actual experience comes on, assumptions are updated for deaths, for lapses, you know the drill. You can also change the liability models. Liability models are updated, like all models, and all of those things can actually create step changes in your liabilities, which you just can't hedge. They just appear. So clearly, collaboration and communication between the investment team and the actuarial team, so assets and liabilities, is absolutely key in order to manage that messaging and to manage those impacts. Now I come back to basis risks and the fact that we have these two curves. I'll show a diagram at the moment of how the curves look like, but effectively, you need to decide, as I've said, whether it's a swap curve or a government curve that you're actually going to be looking at from an assumption setting basis and from an actual derivatives or hedging basis, because they are quite different and they can move very differently in different parts. So you will see a widening of spreads between those two curves and a narrowing of spreads between those curves, and it won't be consistent or parallel across the entire curve. So if you're setting your liability assumptions on the swap curve, if you're going to start using futures or physical assets, you are going to create a significant mismatch because they are priced in the market on a different curve. Similarly, if your liability assumptions are based on a bond curve, as soon as you start using interest rate swaps, again, you're creating a natural mismatch because the swaps are being valued on a different curve to your liabilities. So you really need that consistency in order to mitigate basis risk. And the other one is curve risk. So because it is a curve, curves do twist. So movements aren't parallel. They move in different ways across the curve on any given day. So if liability assumptions are being set on a point in time on that curve, and you're using a a matching program or a hedging program across the entire curve, you're going to create actual significant mismatch risk because the point will only move in one direction, whereas your derivatives or your assets, the values are going to move in quite a different way than what you expect. Bond futures also have other limitations in that there's really only the 3-year bond future and the 10-year bond future. There is a small market in 20-year bond futures, but it hasn't really taken off, doesn't have a lot of liquidity. But even so, that in itself creates curve risk because you cannot match cash flows across an entire curve with just 2 points or 3 points in a curve. And finally, I guess the real assets, it's the ability to actually get the real assets of the different durations. It's not like going to the supermarket at Coles and just saying, I want one of those. It's actually not necessarily easy to get the bonds, especially way out in the larger sort of duration part of the curve, at a price that you're actually willing to pay because cost does come into this as well. So that also can create mismatch risk if you're using an asset portfolio. So curve risk is actually one that's quite difficult to mitigate in its entirety. So it really depends on how you're setting those assumptions. So best case scenario, if you're setting the assumptions on a swap curve, you can use the swaps to hedge them, and that's probably as close as you're going to get, but that does have other consequences, including cost. So I told you there would be a funky graph. There is a funky graph. So what this graph is trying to show is the bond and the swap curve. So I'm just trying to see. The swap curve is in blue above the line and the bond curve is in green. And as you can see, they're not the same shape. And there's actually an inflection point between 15 years and 20 years, which traditionally that would be quite unusual to see an inflection point where you move, the one curve moves above the other, but it's been a lot more common since the GFC. But as you can see, they're not the same. And if you look at the bottom half of that graph, that shows the change in the bond curve and the change in the swap curve. And as you can see, those bars are very different in how they're moving, not only against each other, but across the size of the curve. So traditionally, things were fairly stable and, you know, duration matching probably wasn't a bad thing. People used to do that quite a lot. And then all of a sudden, the GFC came along and it kind of shone a really big light on the fact that that's a very high level match at a very high level world where things just move in parallel, that's fine. But in the real world, that's not how things work. So if you want a true match or a closer match, you really need to take into account the basis and curve risk as well. So like many things in life, there is a control cycle to ALM. So I like control cycles because I'm an actuary. So I'm always happy to see them wherever they pop up. So I think of ALM as being a three-step process. You've got the ex ante, or the beginning step, where you actually analyse and understand where is your risk. You really need to understand those liabilities and how those liabilities move as the market moves, so that you can see what is your risk exposure, what are the gaps. The second step is to have an optimizer of some type to actually determine the amount of asset that you need, so the amount of hedging derivative, or the amount of physical asset, in what durations, what buckets, from what you've looked at in step one, in order to come up with what is it that you need to now purchase. And then step three is actually looking ex post at, well, what did happen? We've now seen what's happened over the month. Does the performance analysis actually show that you were well hedged, or have, you know, does it throw up any discrepancies that you need to think through for your future hedging effectiveness so that you can build that into the program going forward? But overall, regular and transparent monitoring and reporting is absolutely essential with this type of thing, and sharing that information, not just within the investments team, but across, you know, the actuarial team and other areas. So if I look at step one, the top chart with the bars basically is showing the key rate durations of your assets versus your liabilities. So in different buckets, what is the mismatch in duration? And as you can see, there's a bit of a mismatch in this illustrative example across the curve. So that gives you a basis of what you're trying to match. In this case, the limits are $10,000 per basis point. So it's how much is it going to cost you for a one basis point change. That's actually not too bad. This is a reasonably well matched illustration, but that gives you an idea of what you need to look at, as well as the value at risk. So how much would you lose within a 30-day period if things went against you? And that also gives you the different components of interest rates, credit, or inflation. And that gives you an idea of how, whether or not you're happy with your current positions, whether you need to make any changes or, you know, go forward from there. The second step is the optimizer. There are definitely tools out there in the market that you can buy, and they're not cheap, but they certainly exist, that allow you to put in what are your constraints, what are your constraints on the different derivatives or assets that you can use. And that will take your underlying asset and liability data and it will re-optimize and actually give you an answer that says this is what you need to do, and then it will show you what your exposures look like if you do take those actions. And then you can play with that to say, well, that's good, but I'm not happy. I want to do something slightly different, and it will re-optimize for you. And then finally, there's the performance attribution. This is a bit of a busy slide, but basically looking at different metrics to understand the effectiveness of your hedging strategy, be that on interest rates, on the carry that underlies the different assets, on the currency risk, if you've got currency risk in the portfolio, and on the credit spreads. So you can look at different things on different metrics depending on what your program is, in order to tell you, yes, I am matched from an average duration perspective, or I've got this convexity or curve risk, I've got this level of basis risk, etc. So other considerations within other considerations. Cost versus benefit. Unfortunately, unlike today, where we did have a free lunch, there is no free lunch when it comes to ALM. So interest rate futures are very cheap in the market. They don't cost a lot. But they're limited in scope, as I've said before. They can cause curve risk, and they can certainly cause basis risk if, you know, depending on how your assumptions are set. Swaps or over-the-counter derivatives are far more expensive. However, you can then tailor that approach to give you a better outcome. Equally, those type of swaps, they're very heavy on the infrastructure side, so you need to have the back office in place in order to manage them, because you have all of the, as Chidwe said, you've got the whole collateralization, which is a daily collateralization. There's a new standard coming in, CPS 226, which is setting how much initial margin and then ongoing margin you need to have in that collateralization. You need to have ISDA master agreements with different counterparties in order to trade effectively. And you need that expertise in trading. So it's no good just being able to calculate what you want to do. You also need skills within the team to do those trades, or partners in order to do the trading. So there's a lot of operational setup that goes into that in order to support the operational side of derivatives. The other thing from a cost perspective to consider is how frequently are you rebalancing and adjusting your position. So if you're going to readjust every month, that has cost implications, so you need to think that through. Clearly though, if you don't adjust every month, you're going to, you know, quickly move apart from a matched position. So it's that cost versus benefit comes into most aspects. So another thing to consider is that you are potentially dealing with hundreds of millions or billions of dollars worth of interest rate exposure and inflation exposure. So my personal view is it's not an endeavour for a cottage industry. Spreadsheets are great, but spreadsheets are spreadsheets. I think you really are better to invest, if you can, in a proper engine, in a proper piece of technology that will allow you to monitor this on an ongoing basis and allow you to optimise and trade. I think it goes without saying that data accuracy is key. So like anything, it's garbage in, garbage out. So if the liability cash flows or the asset data or the derivatives data are wrong, you are going to have the wrong outcomes. And that's not good. It's not good for the company, and it's certainly not good for you personally. Equally, if there is a mistake made, it can be costly to unwind. Swaps in particular are not cheap, so therefore there's going to be trading costs if you need to change something because a piece of data was incorrect. So data accuracy is really very important. And then finally, as a consideration, we have liquidity as well. So if you're going to be making those margin calls back and forth, you actually need to think through from an investment strategy perspective, if there is a very large move in the market over the course of a day or a week or a month, which certainly can happen, are you going to have the actual cash on hand necessary to make those margin calls each day? So finally, I guess just a word on low interest rates, because I haven't really covered off much in low interest rates. And I guess that's because my view of ALM is that you are trying to manage a risk. So regardless of where interest rates are, the risks are still there, and same with inflation. So people may say, and they do say, that interest rates are historically very low, and that's true. But it is based on past policy, past behaviour, a pre-GFC world, and past relationships, even though that's what we model, don't always feed through to the future on an ongoing basis. They may, but equally they may or not. So who, I guess, would have predicted 4 or 5 years ago that half, you know, a big percentage of the world would have negative interest rates? There would be probably very few people that would have thought that. Or that there would be negative swap spreads so that the swap curve would actually go through the government bond curve, so you would have different curves being higher than each other on different points of the curve. That was relatively unheard of a number of years ago. So I guess that makes you think, well, then what are you trying to achieve? What is your job? Is your job trying to speculate on market rates? And does your board have an express appetite for you to actually do that speculation? And if so, then what sort of a limit do they have? Because some boards are certainly can be happy to take that kind of market risk within different levels, and others have very little tolerance for it. So you really need to, I guess, understand both of those in order to answer the question of does it really matter where interest rates are? But if the answer is no, not really being paid to speculate on the market and my board has no express appetite for this, then I would probably suggest be market agnostic is probably the safest approach for both the business and yourself. So some final thoughts. So if you take nothing away from, I guess, my part of this presentation, there are probably three things that you should remember. One is how much risk is on the table. So it's really important to understand what is your level of risk that is arising from this. The other one is how much is your business actually prepared to pay, and what is your board's tolerance to volatility? So are you targeting P&L reported profit, profit volatility? Are you actually targeting capital or distributable profit volatility? What is it that you're, what is your investment objective is absolutely key to actually understand, and are people willing to pay the outcome of achieving that objective? And then finally, my view is that ALM strategy must follow the liability economic assumptions that are set, and that those assumptions in turn must be set on an ongoing market relative basis if you're going to have an effective and efficient ALM strategy. So thank you for listening.
All right, thank you very much, gentlemen. Now we have come to the time when people can have questions. A few ground rules on this to start with. One is because we do have people on the webinar, it is very important that anybody who's in the room here with us now uses a microphone. So please be patient. Don't get too excited about asking your question. Wait to get the microphone. When you do that, please provide your name and company as well. We are hopefully going to get questions from people who are on the webinar, and I understand they can email them through, and then we will go the very high-tech approach of it being written down on a piece of paper and handed to me. So those are the logistics for the questions. Does anybody have a question to start with? All right. Oh, no, we've got a piece of paper. All right. Okay. Question one, and it's not actually directed at anyone in particular, so I'll give either of you the opportunity to answer. Given the need for timely, relevant, and accurate assets and liabilities for effective investment management, including controls management, for example, collateral and matching and reporting, what is your view of the latest technology infrastructure available to manage assets and liabilities you could recommend from your study to date? So, what do you think? What's the best technology?
That's more your area. I think that's more your area.
Yep. Yep, it's working.
It's working. Okay. So, I'm probably not here to be in a walking advertisement for the software that we do use. and I'm sure that they haven't given me permission to talk about them. However, I'm sure they won't mind me mentioning. We actually use the BlackRock Aladdin software system, so we have they're certainly not the only software system that is out there, but we've found that from an asset and ALM side of the reporting, that's been quite good for us. It does model liabilities, but it doesn't model liabilities the way, say, the profit modelling system would do. So it's as good as it is, and I don't think there's anything out there that's probably better. I'm sure there's things that are equal, but we've found that that's been the best I guess, aggregator and to provide the best level of reporting and analysis that we've thus seen.
Maybe just a comment to add to that. I think there are a number of systems around. What they do tend to do is leapfrog each other. So you can make a decision that one system looks great, and then a year or two later, suddenly one of the ones you thought looked like rubbish is really, really good. Mm. I don't know what the answer is to that, but that is something that we face. The next question. Given capital market constraints in respect of depth, optionality and basis relevance, market constraints of assets and derivatives available to match the liabilities, please share your experiences in managing basis risk and communication and justification to management or the board on this. Their concerns are the overall portfolio or dividend payout. So communication.
So I think with all of this, communication is key. If you're setting up an ALM strategy, the first thing you really need is a proper investment objective. And you shouldn't be making that up yourself. You should certainly be recommending something, but it really does depend on what the board and senior management are hoping to get out of this. And as Chidwe said, you can't do everything. You can't have your cake and eat it too. You have to focus on one aspect or another. Basis risk, if you can set your assumptions on the swap curve and you feel that that's a sensible way to set the assumptions, and you're happy to pay the cost of the swaps, and you have the infrastructure, I guess, to manage those as well at the back end, that will give you the best approach for actually managing basis risk and curve risk. If you don't have those things, then it's really a matter of making sure you're consistent so that you're at the ALM strategy follows how the assumptions are being set so that you're not inadvertently adding risk that you don't think you're adding. And if you do need to add that risk because there is no other alternative, you need to, again, clearly communicate that to boards and management committees. This is the sorts of outcomes that you're going to be expecting to get, including sensitivity analysis of if things do go pear-shaped in the market, what is kind of some of the extreme consequences that can come out of that? Because just being parallel hedged is great if things do move in a parallel way, which does sometimes happen. People need to understand what the consequences are if that's not the case.
I think you covered most of the points already.
All right. Any other questions here? Oh, we've got a question. Yep.
Yes, hi. My name is Chris Johnson from Suncorp. I was curious to hear your thoughts around the considerations as part of the strategic asset allocation for the board management, particularly around this P&L versus capital trade-off where, as you say, you can only really immunise against one or the other, and shareholders like profit and dividends. So I wonder, in terms of like some companies you may have worked at or just some industry considerations around it, what would be the kind of favourite of the two? Would it be profitability or would it be dividends?
It really depends on your company. So if you're already hitting the profit targets year on year, and dividends may become the focus, but if your excess assets position is fairly thin and you don't want to risk that, that's where you move towards a longer H capital. It varies from company to company, but the most important thing is to you get your board across your objectives here and draw out the risk. So you have to draw out the risk very early on. As I think I pointed an example when I was speaking about this early on, that should be the focus.
From what I've seen, everybody wants what they don't have. So if you are hedging to profit, then people will definitely be asking you the questions when they see the capital sensitivities of, oh, really, why are you doing that? Equally the other way around. So it's really important to have that conversation up front and probably make it part of an ongoing conversation, because it does depend on the personalities sitting around the board and sitting around management, and that does change over time. So it's important to understand where it is that they're sitting. Personally, I'll be very happy when DAC goes away, because my job becomes a hell of a lot easier. And while they won't be exactly the same, they'll be very, very similar. So that will solve that issue for me once and for all.
All right, another question from the webinar. This directed to Anthony. With responsibilities across both investment and ALM, have you encountered conflicting objectives? And if so, how do you juggle them?
To be honest, no. We do it all as part of the same process. So I've got separate teams. But if I'm putting up a strategic asset allocation for a portfolio where there are ALM consequences, then an ALM strategy will go up at the same time. And it really comes down to understanding what the investment objectives are. So as long as you understand what the investment objective is, it actually works quite well to be able to say, and in my view, probably it's almost essential to be able to say, I'm setting asset strategy at the same time as I'm setting ALM strategy, because those two really need to work hand in glove in order to get the right outcome. So I wouldn't, I guess, see it as a conflict so much. I would see it as two things that need to work together in order to get the one investment objective at the end via both the asset side of the strategy and the derivatives or the hedging side of the strategy.
And do you have somebody else who's responsible for monitoring outcomes, or do you do that as well?
No, that would be dangerous. So we also have a market risk team, and the market risk team is actually, we do monitor, but from a line two perspective, we do have a market risk team that monitors and reports on those risks and outcomes as well, so that you do need that level of independent oversight. You're probably not good to do everything yourself.
Okay, very good. Do we have a question over here? Yep.
Hi, Michael Ramsey from QB Insurance. I know a lot of the presentation and conversations focused on the life side, but Anthony, I don't know if you've had much experience with the ALM becoming sure from the general side, and whether there's some different considerations that you might look at for the two approaches.
Probably not something we've looked at as much. We do have an ALM view of the general insurance side, but because of the nature of the common short book, it's all very short tail. So you're talking about durations sort of spanning the 1 to 6 months mainly, with a little bit out to 2 years. So it's a much simpler book. But we do give it a view of ALM from the point of view of you can set your investment objective such that it's back to a liability profile, and then looking at, you know, whether or not you use derivatives or you just use short-dated cash and bonds. Are you, from a duration perspective, how matched are you, and whether or not you need to sort of move those positions? So it's a much simpler world, I guess, for us personally, but of course it wouldn't be if we did have, you know, a lot of long tail. It's probably not something I've personally looked at, but I would imagine it would be quite similar types of things that you would actually need to think about in a long tail sort of book.
I might ask a question to Chidwe. So you raised the issue of Solvency II and matching adjustments and all that sort of stuff. Is this something some of your global colleagues have had to deal with? Because I suppose my understanding is a lot of business kind of ground to a halt for a year or so as people tried to deal with restructuring portfolios to get the matching adjustment. So have you been in conversations with them about that at all?
No, not in my experience, but it's an interesting topic though. I can see that APRA has taken some of that into considerations when setting the capital charges. Yeah. In one of my slides, I looked at the capital charges on equities and credit risk, and they're quite different. If you look at a credit risk charge of 6%, it's much less than what we observed during the GFC. Its credit spreads are blowing out to 300 or 700 bips. Mm-hmm. Then, so part of it is already recognized, but in terms of the process to set up, to the process you need to go through to put in the market adjustment, I have not gone through that, but it's interesting to know it takes 1 or 2 years. But as industry, I think that's something we could push for.
Yeah, I think there might be others who've got a view on it, but my understanding is the matching adjustment's quite... there are very strict rules around whether you can use it or not, and so people have had to restructure their portfolios and put together a variety of structures to make it work. Don't know if it's something APRA would ultimately be open to, but we'll see. Other questions internally? Okay, I'll go to another one from the email. Hang on. Just while it's getting there, I'll ask this one if that's okay. How is responsibility for ALM delegated on a day-to-day basis between asset management side and actuarial liability valuation side to ensure effective application of strategy and cost effectiveness?
I kind of covered this in my slide before. So if your liability profile is fairly standard and you can get the cash flows and things like that fairly easily and fairly reliable, then it could just sit with the investment team. You just have to provide the liability cash flows and the investment team will be able to do it on whichever system you have that. But when the liability profile is complicated and you have complex features, optionality or otherwise, it may sit with the actuarial team because they will need to look into that in a bit more detail.
Okay, great.
Oh, it's Chris Johnson here again from Suncorp. You mentioned the deferred acquisition costs, the DAC, as part of the life business, which is typically a large number for most life insurers. It's very sensitive to the changes in yields and the tax impact. I was curious if you've come across any hedging strategies, particularly around that, just to kind of immunise out that impact?
Yeah, I mean, if you're trying to hedge out the impact of reported profit volatility, which is, you know, there are many things you can be trying to achieve, and that's certainly one that you can try to achieve, you can use the same kind of derivative type strategies. So you can, depending on how those assumptions are being set, use a bond futures and bond portfolio or an interest rate swap portfolio. And it really is a matter of which liability cash flows you're using. So you know, there's the capital cash flows or there's the P&L style cash flows that include the DAC. And you can model that through. And then as a result, it changes the average duration, obviously, but it also changes the cash flow profile of your liabilities. And it's really like anything. If you know the cash flow profile of your liabilities and how they move in relation to interest rates, then you can actually come up with an optimized hedging program to match that. So the question is that what you want to do? Is that what you want to achieve? Or do you want to achieve something else? And that's generally not up to the investment team, happily. That's usually somebody else is making those calls.
Well, a question from me, actually. So when you were talking about inflation, hedging inflation, and in particular caps and floors, the major thing you referred to was sort of future sum insured and premium, which should kind of move together. But you'll have other things like claims in course of payment reserves and annuities, which probably have caps and floors on their inflation rate. And probably when they were written, the zero floor was well out of the money, and it's a bit closer to the money these days. So do you have a view on how you might hedge that or how your philosophy might change in the current environment?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think that comes back to the fallacy of there is a perfect hedge. So it really is a matter of, it's like anything, the 80-20 rule. It's not possible to be able to match everything perfectly. So if you feel that you can actually match the vast majority of that risk, and the important thing is to point out the parts of that risk where you are going to get variations, you are going to get deviations, the fact that there are caps and floors. You can't go out to the market and buy a derivative really that's got that cap or floor in there. So it's not something that you can really manage, in my view, but it's certainly something that you can communicate to say this is the residual risk that we're not really able to manage, so that can be monitored to see how big it gets, especially as interest rates change or the market changes. But unfortunately, we've got some very, very interesting products out there over the past 30, 40, 50 years that's still around. So it's just a matter of understanding those things. You may not be able to manage them, but at least if you understand them, I think you're a fair way there.
And how much do you interact with product development and pricing in respect of new products to make sure they understand that and price them appropriately?
Probably traditionally, not as much as we should, but it has been something that's been increasing. Certainly on the annuity side of the business, that relationship is extremely close. On the life insurance risk pricing side of the business, it's probably developing, I would say, in my own organisation.
It's become an increasing focus now with some of the liability profiles tied to wage inflation and things like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, having some growth assets in your portfolio would help as well. In that instance, but inflation-linked bonds are expensive and it's not an easy thing to hedge. And as Anthony has pointed out, the most important thing is to draw out the risk and to work with the product and pricing team to change the terms in certain cases where you don't have unlimited exposure to wage inflation. For example, you need to cap some somewhere, and it always helps with communication.
Great. All right, another question from the webinar. How transparent are the optimization tools, and what are the considerations in choosing these tools?
That's a good question, because you don't want a black box. And I know when we went through the process, which took quite a while to actually put the tool through, there was a huge amount of testing across the investments team, the actuarial team, the market risk team, and also the operational risk team all had a go at actually looking at the tools and making sure they could understand for the programs that we already had in place, were things moving the way that we expected them to. So that is a key question. And like any piece of software, you are somewhat reliant on the supplier, so it really is a matter of getting that level of trust. So it clearly helps if it's something that's known fairly well and is used fairly widely in the industry, because then you can actually have some level of understanding that it's not just you using this, there is a lot of people using this. But being able, I guess, to come up with a spreadsheet to at least at a reasonable level of detail replicate what that's doing and then using that as a test is a way that you can actually get some level of comfort that, you know, you're not creating this next black box that no one will ever understand.
And how much is that optimization tool just an algorithm, and how much is the vendor providing sort of underlying data on market pricing as well?
In this case, we provide the different, or as an organisation, we provide the input of the indices to the tool as well. So a lot of that is coming, I guess, in-house as far as how that works. But they clearly have a role to play with the actual, you know, how that's all calculated and used. So it is, you do need to have a very strong partnership, I guess. From our point of view, it's a piece of software, so it's not like a box sitting in the corner. It is something that is a software web application type thing. But the data feeds that go into it are absolutely critical, clearly, and actually understanding how the modelling works that it does, but equally how all of that data gets fed in, and the checks and balances that go into that is all quite critical.
And then you actually hand that off to somebody internally to actually execute trades, or is it all straight through?
For us, I've got a part of my team does the execution of the trades as well. So I've got within the ALM team, I do have that skill set, but equally then I've got the investment operations team that can handle the collateralization aspects.
Okay. Any other questions? Going once, going twice?
I have one for Anthony.
Oh, go for it.
In one of your slides, you had the inflection point where the swap curve was below the government bond curve. What's your view there? What's driving that?
Sadly, not an economist. I think it has a lot to do with quantitative easing and, you know, globally, and the fact that the markets have been quite largely interfered with globally. So it's probably a bit artificial, but we live in a world where that's not going away anytime soon. So my personal view is that it definitely would have something to do with that sort of a profile. And just the liquidity and the requirements now on different merchant banks of what they have to hold and how they make the markets in swaps, all of those things come into it with those curves. So in a perfect world, we would just have one curve and our life would be easy, but sadly not.
Do you think there's anything in that the bond curve is effectively a funded curve, whereas the swap curve is unfunded, so you've got a weight of money aspect?
I think that's also part of it too, is how much money and liquidity is out there, what is the government issuing, how is all that? Yeah, there's a lot of aspects that comes into those curves.
All right, well, thank you everyone for your attendance. Can I ask you to join me in thanking our presenters?